What about the Equalization of Opportunity Bill?
You don't think it's going to exist 3 years from now, do you? We've given them such a demonstration that all that rot is going to be swept away. The whole country is with us. Who will want to stop things now? Who will listen to the bilge? There's a lobby of the better kind of men working in Washington right this moment. They're going to get the Equalization Bill scrapped at the next session.
I hope so.
I've had a terrible time these last few weeks getting the new furnaces started. But it's all set now. They're being built. I can sit back and take it easy. I can sit at my desk, rake in the money, loaf like a bum, watch the orders for the metal pouring in, and play favorites all over the place. Say, what's the first train you've got for Philadelphia tomorrow morning?
Oh, I don't know.
You don't? What's the use of an operating vice president? I have to be at the mills by 7 tomorrow. Got anything running around 6?
5:30 a.m. is the first one, I think.
Will you wake me up in time to make it, or would you rather order the train held for me?
I'll wake you up. She sat, watching him as he remained silent. He had looked tired when he came in. The lines of exhaustion were gone from his face now.
Dagny? He asked suddenly.
His tone had changed. There was some hidden earnest note in his voice.
Why didn't you want to see me in public?
I don't want to be part of your official life.
He did not answer.
In a moment, he asked casually,
When did you take a vacation last?
I think it was 3 years ago.
What did you do?
Went to the Adirondacks for a month. Came back in a week.
I did that 5 years ago, only it was Oregon.
He lay flat on his back looking at the ceiling.
Dagny, let's take a vacation together. Let's take my car and drive away for a few weeks, anywhere. Just drive down the back roads where no one knows us. We'll leave no address, we won't look at a newspaper, we won't touch a phone. We won't have any official life at all.
She got up. She approached him. She stood by the side of the couch, looking down at him, the light of the lamp behind her. She did not want him to see her face and the effort she was making not to smile.
You can take a few weeks off, can't you? He said. Things are set and going now.
It's safe. We won't have another chance in the next 3 years. All right, Hank, she said, forcing her voice to sound calmly toneless.
Will you?
When do you want to start?
Monday morning.
All right. She turned a step away. He seized her wrist, pulled her down, swung her body to lie stretched full length on top of him. He held her still, uncomfortably, as she had fallen, his one hand in her hair pressing her mouth to his other hand moving from the shoulder blades under her thin blouse to her waist, to her legs. She whispered, "And you say I don't need you." She pulled herself away from him and stood up, brushing her hair off her face. He lay still, looking up at her, his eyes narrowed, the bright flicker of some particular interest in his eyes, intent and faintly mocking. She glanced down. A strap of her slip had broken. The slip hung diagonally from her one shoulder to her side, and he was looking at her breast under the transparent film of the blouse. She raised her hand to adjust the strap. He slapped her hand down. She smiled in understanding, in answering mockery. She walked slowly, deliberately across the room, and leaned against a table, facing him, her hands holding the table's edge, her shoulders thrown back. It was the contrast he liked, the severity of her clothes and the half-naked body. The railroad executive who was a woman he owned. He sat up. He sat leaning comfortably across the couch, his legs crossed and stretched forward, his hands in his pockets, looking at her with the glance of a property appraisal.
"Did you say you wanted a transcontinental track of Reardon metal, Mr. Vice President?" he asked. "What if I don't give it to you? I can choose my customers now and demand any price I please. If this were a year ago, I would have demanded that you sleep with me in exchange."
"I wish you had."
"Would you have done it?"
"Of course."
"As a matter of business? As a sale?"
"If you were the buyer. You would have liked that, wouldn't you?"
"Would you?"
"Yes," she whispered. He approached her,
He grasped her shoulders and pressed his mouth to her breast through the thin cloth. Then, holding her, he looked at her silently for a long moment. "What did you do with that bracelet?" he asked. They had never referred to it. She had to let a moment pass to regain the steadiness of her voice. "I have it," she answered. "I want you to wear it. If anyone guesses, it will be worse for you than for me. Wear it." She brought out the bracelet of Reardon metal. She extended it to him without a word, looking straight at him, the green-blue chain glittering across her palm. Holding her glance, he clasped the bracelet on her wrist. In the moment when the clasp clicked shut under his fingers, she bent her head down to them and kissed his hand. The earth went flowing under the hood of the car. Uncoiling from among the curves of Wisconsin's hills, the highway was the only evidence of human labor, a precarious bridge stretched across a sea of brush, weeds, and trees. The sea rolled softly in sprays of yellow and orange, with a few red jets shooting up on the hillsides, with pools of remnant green in the hollows, under a pure blue sky. Among the colors of a picture postcard, the car's hood looked like the work of a jeweler, with the sun sparkling on its chromium steel, and its black enamel reflecting the sky. Dagny leaned against the corner of the side window, her legs stretched forward. She liked the wide, comfortable space of the car's seat, and the warmth of the sun on her shoulders. She thought that the countryside was beautiful. "What I'd like to see," said Reardon, "is a billboard." She laughed. He had answered her silent thought. "Selling what, and to whom? We haven't seen a car or a house for an hour." "That's what I don't like about it." He bent forward a little, his hands on the wheel. He was frowning. "Look at that road." The long strip of concrete was bleached to the powdery gray of bones left on a desert, as if sun and snows had eaten away the traces of tires, oil and carbon, the lustrous polish of motion. Green weeds rose from the angular cracks of the concrete. No one had used the road or repaired it for many years, but the cracks were few. "It's a good road," said Reardon. "It was built to last. The man who built it must have had a good reason for expecting it to carry a heavy traffic in the years ahead." "Yes." "I don't like the looks of this."
"I don't either."
Then she smiled. "But think how often we've heard people complain that billboards ruin the appearance of the countryside. Well, there's the unruined countryside for them to admire." She added, "They're the people I hate." She did not want to feel the uneasiness which she felt like a thin crack under her enjoyment of this day. She had felt that uneasiness at times in the last 3 weeks at the sight of the country streaming past the wedge of the car's hood. She smiled. It was the hood that had been the immovable point in her field of vision, while the earth had gone by. It was the hood that had been the center, the focus, the security in a blurred, dissolving world. The hood before her, and Reardon's hands on the wheel by her side. She smiled, thinking that she was satisfied to let this be the shape of her world. After the first week of their wandering, when they had driven at random, at the mercy of unknown crossroads, he had said to her one morning as they started out, "Dagny, does resting have to be purposeless?" She had laughed, answering, "No, what factory do you want to see?" He had smiled at the guilt he did not have to assume, at the explanations he did not have to give. And he had answered, "It's an abandoned ore mine around Saginaw Bay that I've heard about. They say it's exhausted." They had driven across Michigan to the ore mine. They had walked through the ledges of an empty pit with the remnants of a crane like a skeleton bending above them against the sky, and someone's rusted lunchbox clattering away from under their feet. She had felt a stab of uneasiness, sharper than sadness. But Reardon had said cheerfully, "Exhausted, hell. I'll show them how many tons and dollars I can draw out of this place." On their way back to the car, he had said, "If I could find the right man, I'd buy that mine for him tomorrow morning and set him up to work it." The next day, when they were driving west and south toward the plains of Illinois, he had said suddenly, after a long silence, "No, I'll have to wait till they junk the bill. The man who could work that mine wouldn't need me to teach him. The man who'd need me wouldn't be worth a damn.